This is On Target St. John's. A look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
Good afternoon, everyone. As we all know, Newfoundland and Labrador continues to struggle with a rapidly aging population and ways to attract and retain young people who for generations have sought their fortunes elsewhere. Couple that with smaller families and you have a recipe for economic disaster. The provincial government has been working on ways to address one of the greatest impediments to raising families, the high cost of childcare. Full-day kindergarten and $25 a day childcare initiatives are intended to help. Here to speak more about early childhood education and some of the initiatives to help improve supports for children and their families is Dr. David Philpott. He's a retired professor with MUNS Faculty of Education. He's also a research associate with the Atkinson Center for Society and Child Development. Hello, David Philpott.
Good afternoon, Linda.
So why are childcare issues so essential to society as a whole?
Oh, my God, the pandemic. If the pandemic has taught us anything, it has taught us the fragility in the childcare sector and the impact of that fragility on our economy, on our families, on our communities. When childcare spaces dried up and parents had to work at home, they went into crises very, very quickly across the country. And it's underscored the need for us to be looking at this sector more closely. My area has been special education. I've been in special education for 40 years, which is a long time. And the whole focus of special education is early intervention and early identification and intervention. But we've had very poor results in those 40 years. We have not changed the needle at all on special education. And in 2010, I became involved with the McCain Family Foundation, whose focus is the early years. And they exposed me to the literature, to the research, to the international research on the benefits of early child education. And through the leadership of Margie McCain and Jane Bertrand and Kerry McQuaig, who led us very, very well on gaining awareness on the benefits of early child education, this province has started to improve and start to move forward to support young families and young children.
You spoke about early intervention and your focus, your career has been focused on special education. How does early childhood education mesh with special education in that it's so important to get that early intervention when it comes to learning disabilities, ADHD, autism, the list goes on.
Absolutely. I mean, the international research on the benefits of early child education shows that it boosts a child's literacy, numeracy, language skills, social skills, and behavior regulation, especially those with low socioeconomic status. And we know that 60% of children in special education are there because of lags in literacy, numeracy, language, social skills, and behavior regulation, especially those with low socioeconomic status. So the connection is overwhelmingly clear on how the two mesh together. And no one knows better than a parent of the critical importance of getting early support for all children, not just those with identified exceptionalities.
Early childhood education also identifies some of these things that a parent might suspect something is going on, but families are smaller now. Fewer families have someone to compare their child to, if you know what I mean. If the child is two or three or four, and we don't have those same social groups. As we all know, COVID has shone a light on that. We can't interact like we once did. So how important is early childhood education in identifying some of these things that a parent might suspect but not really know?
Well, you're right. Families have changed. Communities have changed. Economies have changed. I mean, when I grew up in a family of eight, and we had neighbors around us with families of 12 and 14 children. The back garden was an early child education center. It was language rich. It wasn't always language positive, but it was language rich. And you know, child development in that group context was both facilitated and observed. Someone was always watching out for us. So there's always a set of eyes on us. And now that's totally different. The nature of play has changed. Children are much more passive. They are much more isolated. They are alone. Language skills only develop when a child needs to use language skills more often than not in a peer context. Motor development, you know, needs to be facilitated by active play. So parents know intuitively that, you know, even though they have less families, even though less children, even though they are more busy with careers and whatnot, they know the importance of connecting their children with other children to optimize that development. And that, the, you know, 80% of the brain is developed by 6 years of age. So what happens in those early years sets the trajectory for those children across their lifespans.
You mentioned that passivity, and what a lot of us do now is we hand the iPad over to the child and they play a few games, but there's no interaction happening. It's, as you say, it's a passive type of play. It's not overly creative. So are children missing out to a degree if they're not involved in social groups with other young children? Are they, do they stand to, I don't know, see any lasting effects from that?
Oh, yes. I mean, a friend of mine is an occupational therapist, and she says, and she's been practicing for a very long time, and she says that, you know, 10, 15 years ago, a child would skip into her office and it would take her 3 days to teach a child how to ride a bike. Now a child comes into her office and takes her a week to teach a child how to skip. So, you know, motor development in children is down. Language skills in children is down. Behavior regulation, how to play, how to interact, how to take turns, how to be patient, how to be appropriate with peers. All of that only occurs when there's other children around, when they're exposed to other children. I worry for the children in, you know, higher socioeconomic brackets, in the higher income families, with these young children alone in big houses with no other children to interact with and spending most of their time interacting with adults. We know that that's not healthy for child development. And while it's a safe, nurturing environment, it's not always a skill-rich environment.
It's funny, we were having that very conversation in the newsroom this morning, talking about, you know, growing up, and there were youngsters everywhere. You know, you had very little chance of not meeting up with a youngster somewhere. Going out around the bay in particular, I fondly remember there were kids everywhere. You always made a friend or were making friends along the way. Now our activities tend to be much more structured. They tend to be sports-related events, which are not bad. They're all good. But we need a lot of that unstructured play where we make our own rules and we decide how that works.
Well, and that's why a play-based curriculum approach for the early years and for kindergarten, junior kindergarten, is critical. Children, we all learn best if we have an opportunity to do and to interact, it be that cooking or gardening or whatever. Get ourselves involved in it, and that's how you learn. And the same with young children. They learn by interacting with other children. That incidental learning that goes on, that on-the-spot opportunity to help a child process and figure out a different way to do something or to help explain what's happening as it happens in real life is the best way to teach things. I mean, 40 years in special education, we spent an inordinate amount of time doing role-playing with children, going back and trying to, you know, recreate an event to help them understand what happened and walk through, you know, and acquire a different way to do it the next time around. Role-playing helps, but it doesn't compare to the benefits of incidental teaching, you know, reinforcing skills as they emerge and as they occur in real life.
Strikes me, too, that dealing with conflict is ever so important. We all tend to shy away from any form of conflict. We let it all go on social media, but in our face-to-face interactions, and children are always getting into little tussles and scuffles and hurt feelings and all those kinds of things, and that's a learning process as well.
Well, that's a healthy learning process, actually. That's how we learn. We all learn by our mistakes more often than not. Same with children. But those mistakes and those errors and those challenges need to be processed appropriately, you know, at the time. And that's why we need qualified early child educators. That's why we need a strong play-based curriculum. And that's why we need curriculum guides to help, you know, these educators really, you know, take advantage of the opportunities as they arise and reinforce skills in real life context.
My guest today is Dr. David Philpott. He's a retired professor with Munns Faculty of Education. He's also a research associate with the Atkinson Center for Society and Child Development. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And my guest today on Target is Dr. David Philpott. We're talking about early childhood education. And David, your career was based primarily on special education, but you became more and more interested in early education. Why?
Well, as I said earlier, because I saw the link. I mean, I saw the futility of what we were doing in special education. We weren't moving the needle. We weren't, you know, changing the trajectory of children's lives. Because by the time we were getting these children, you know, it was too late. You know, they were 10, 7, 10 or older years of age. And by then, you know, the brain had developed, skills and habits had been acquired. They were so far behind academically, there's no way to help them catch up. And yes, we did good work in special education. And we still do good work in special education. But if you really want to have an impact, you got to go into the earlier years and catch these children earlier in their development.
What are your thoughts on $25 a day childcare?
Oh, I'm in full support of it, and I applaud the Premier in his support of it. And I support it because the research supports it. We know that capping fees for parents moves us closer to a universal model of childcare, giving families and parents greater access. It pays for itself with return to work in a higher tax base. I mean, 43% of families with a stay-at-home mom live below the poverty line. Children with ECE have higher educational outcomes. They lower draws in social programs. They have higher paying jobs. They become more engaged citizens. They're healthier. They're more productive contributors in society. And we know that the return on that investment is somewhere between one, for every dollar invested, we get back $1.50 to $3 on that investment. So not only is it wise social policy, it is wise economic policy.
You're also an advocate for full-day kindergarten. Why?
Oh, I've been a long-time advocate for full-day kindergarten because, again, the research supports it. In Newfoundland, in 2016, when we brought in full-day kindergarten, it was exceptionally controversial because people thought we were scrapping the K-12 system to bring in the expensive Cadillac service of full-day kindergarten and that there was no need of it. Well, we were actually one of the last provinces in Canada to get full-day kindergarten. And I was exceptionally outspoken about that. I mean, when Margie McCain and I wrote an op-ed piece in the Telegram, I received an awful lot of personal flack for that. And then the day after it started in September, everyone loved it. The tide turned overnight. Educators as much as parents loved it. So when I went to the Premier's task force in 2016, 2017, not only did we look at the benefits of full-day kindergarten, but we also looked at the benefits of a junior kindergarten. Again, because the research overwhelmingly supports it. We know that countries that have the best educational outcomes have the strongest early years program. We know what's happening in Ontario with the two-year kindergarten experience, that what's happening in Northwest Territories, what's happening in Nova Scotia, what's happening in many parts of the world. And we know that a two-year kindergarten program that begins at age four, continues until the child turns six, in a combined classroom with a play-based curriculum, with trained early child educators and a strong instructional team who really get to know that child for 2 years, we know that those kids thrive once they move into grade one.
I want to talk about, because you're hinting at junior kindergarten now, and I want to talk about that more extensively in a moment. But what was the idea behind half-day kindergarten? Was it simply an old idea that just never got updated?
Well, it was a very old concept of school begins at six. A child is ready to learn at 6 years of age. I mean, and that's age old. And in fact, PEI was one of the last provinces to bring in a kindergarten experience. They never had a kindergarten experience at all until they moved to a full-day kindergarten experience. And of course, research and knowledge today tells us that 80% of the child's brain is developed by the time they turn six. So if you're going to have an impact, you got to reach these children earlier. And the half-day kindergarten started as an introduction to school, but it never shifted, even though people railed against it. I mean, this province, both in government and outside government, has been looking at full-day kindergarten for many, many years. And parents in particular, especially when parents returned to work, they knew the disruption of a half-day placement was caused that family, you know, having to move the child, transport the child, find a half-time placement in a child center, even though more often than not they had to pay for a full-time placement to hold on to their space. The cost of that, the interruption of that, they called it the year from hell, was how parents will describe that half-day kindergarten experience. And now the support for the full-day kindergarten is overwhelming.
It's funny. It's only just a few years ago. My son was among the last of the half-day kindergarten. I lived what you just expressed there. It seemed phenomenal to me that I would be, taking him out of school half a day and then putting him into a childcare center who was doing essentially the same thing. It just had this disruption in his day and my day.
Well, we also know there's a research study done in Ontario by Jan Pelchate who looked at children who had one school placement versus those who had half-time school placement and had to move for a preschool and an after-school program, and looked at the child's perspectives on their days. And it discovered that the children who had a full-day placement, they talked about, their friends, what they did, what they learned, how much fun they had. Whereas the children who had to move spaces, they spent their time talking about who got them where, how they moved. They were constantly weren't settled at any point during the day because they knew they were coming or going somewhere. And that disruption causes mental health issues in children. That lack of structure, that lack of stability is extremely detrimental to young children.
Especially in a climate like we have here in Canada, in Newfoundland and Labrador, where, it's not just putting a child in a car, it's getting them dressed and all of the stuff that goes with that and the, oh my gosh, how many tears and snot and everything do I recall from that year? It's extraordinary.
The year from hell.
Indeed. So you hinted at junior kindergarten. What is that exactly, and how can it benefit children and families?
Well, we recommend that the task force recommended that we go with Ontario and Northwest Territories model, which is, as I said, it's a 2-year experience in which the children start at age 4. They stay in the same classroom with 4- and 5-year-olds, with the same teacher, with the same curriculum, the same learning opportunities. They have more time, basically. And the teacher has more time to get to know them. And the families have more time to get to know the teacher and solidify relationships and create effective communication channels. So that by the time the child is ready to move to grade 1 at 6, any issues in that child have been identified. That teacher really knows that child and that family. They've had them for 2 years. And any interventions or any supports or any challenges are well identified and are well, remediated or certainly supported by then. And the studies out of Ontario and Northwest Area and now Nova Scotia have glowing reports that, like your experience with the half-day kindergarten, the 4- and 5-year-old parents of the 4- and 5-year-olds, love it, and the children thrive in those environments. In 2017, when I did the task force, we identified 62 schools in Newfoundland with fewer than 15 4- and 5-year-old children, and 43 of them had fewer than 5 4- and 5-year-olds. And these are communities where private centers are not possible, and there are absolutely no services for the early years. A private system is not viable in these communities because there's not enough children. So those are communities in which we can implement junior kindergarten at absolutely no expense and reap the benefits. I mean, the argument exists that those children, more than any other group of children, given how isolated they are, they need that early stimulation and early exposure and early interaction more than anyone else.
Has there, what's government or elected officials' response been to the concept of early kindergarten in this province?
Well, right after the task force submitted our report, government did a public consultation on the support for junior kindergarten, given the backlash to full-day kindergarten when they brought it in. And they received more submissions to that call for input than any other submission that they've done. A lot of people spoke out about junior kindergarten, and every single person was in support of it. Every single one, which shows, one, the overwhelming groundswell of public support for this, the shift in public thinking and the recognition of the importance of the early years. Government accepted our recommendation. I know that they are in the process of figuring out how to bring it in, how to phase it in. We recommended that they phase it in, as was done in Ontario and Northwest Territories, that learned from your mistakes, to start in those small communities where there was absolutely no expense, and work towards the challenges of bringing it into the larger centers, such as St. John's and Eastern Avalon, which which has, you know, larger populations of children, and it will mean new construction to or additions to some schools. A lot of support for it. I've spoke to the premier. I've spoke to the ministers of education that have come and gone. I've spoke to the deputies, the assistant deputies, and senior bureaucrats. Everyone wants this. Everyone recognizes it's a good idea. They have to figure out how to get it. And I do know that the paper for the cabinet paper to start this was literally at the doors of cabinet when the pandemic hit. And of course, the pandemic has delayed everything, including junior kindergarten. So as of right now, I don't know where they are with that plan. I would imagine that they're trying to figure out a way to cost it out.
What will be the impact on early child care centers?
Well, what we know from other jurisdictions that brought it in, when it comes in, there's an outcry from the early sector saying, or the service provider saying, that this is going to kill them and they're going to end up closing. And what we discovered is that the opposite happens, that because they have a more homogeneous population of students, it's easier for them to operate. There's less regulations. There's regulations for the services for an infant, for a toddler, for a four-year-old, for a five-year-old, and for after-school kids. So all these centers are dealing with endless regulations. And when they have a smaller, more defined population of children, it's easier for them to become more focused on meeting the needs of that group. And, of course, as moms start to return to work at 4 years of age, there's more demand in the early years. There's no reason for a mom not to be able to go back to work earlier if she chooses. So demand goes up, quality goes up, and these centers, you know, continue. Some of them close, depending on how they're operating and who they're focused on and where they're located. But for the most part, the sector becomes more focused, and early child educators, anything we do to professionalize the early child educator sector, draws more people back to the profession. It becomes a more viable career path for them.
Could it open up more spaces?
Yes, absolutely. If you take the four-year-olds, that's why junior kindergarten is a critical part of the $25 a day. $25 a day is an important step, but it's only a step. The JK is a critical piece of that, because it will take the four-year-olds out of the early years mix, as it did the five-year-olds, and therefore more spaces become available. If you take all the four-year-olds out and put them into the school system, suddenly there's a lot more spaces.
My guest today on Target is Dr. David Philpott. We're talking about early childhood education and some of the initiatives that are used in other jurisdictions, and some of which are being introduced here. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
My guest today is Dr. David Philpott. He's a retired professor with Munns Faculty of Education, also a research associate with the Atkinson Center for Society and Child Development. And I'm saying that like I know what it is, but what is the Atkinson Center for Society and Child Development?
I didn't know what it was either until I became involved in them. It's a federal think tank, really, on the importance of the early years and that, the impact of that on society. So it's situated at the University of Toronto. It's funded by a number of philanthropic foundations who support the early years. And it's a collection, really, of academics and scholars and public policy people who are passionate and interested in pushing out public conversations and informing public policy on the importance of the early years.
You mentioned as well the McCain Family Foundation. I believe you've been with the Jimmy Pratt Foundation as well?
Yes, since 2010. Jimmy Pratt and the McCain Foundation partnered in 2010 to do a three-year initiative to push public policy on the early years. And together, we did a lot of good work under the leadership of the McCain Foundation, who have been in this game for a very, very long time and are immensely knowledgeable. When I started, in 2010, this was not my area. I did not know very much about early child education, the sector at all. And as I went into the literature, they really educated me, really. And since then, I've gone on to do a number of research projects and whatnot on the sector. And it's a fascinating and very rewarding sector.
So how essential is their work, and what has it meant in terms of getting these very important topics on the table?
Oh, my God, it's been crucial to inform a public debate and to draw awareness. I mean, we came out with a series of discussion papers. The early years last a lifetime. It was the first one. The second one was called Growing Education Down to Include the Early Years. And it wasn't opinion. It was research-based. All we did was to make the research, make the evidence available to the public, inform the public, inform the government, inform the institutions, and, you know, once awareness goes up, demand for quality programs goes up. And we saw that. I mean, Newfoundland, in 2010, when we started, we had one of the poorest models of early child education in the country. And in 2014, we had one of the most improved models of education in the country. So, you know, the impact has been significant and continues to be significant because government listens. Government really listens to this. They want to, they want to do the right thing on this because it's to their benefit in the long term. I mean, if they can reduce the numbers of kids in special education, if they can increase the number of working moms, if they can attract young families to the province, if they can increase the birth rate, if they can lower the draws in socioeconomic program or social programs and healthcare programs across the lifespan, government benefits, you know, taxpayers benefit, you and I benefit, whether we have children or not. So it's that broader social good that's really the mandate of the Atkinson Centre and what's really the thriving or the driving force behind the foundations and pushing for public discourse.
What is the Early Years Education Report Card?
Well, that's the Early Years Education Report Card was a part of the Early Year Study 3 that was released in 2013, and audience members might want to Google that, Early Year Study 3. I think it's Early Years Study 3, the earlyyearstudy.ca, but you can easily find it. Since then, there's been another version, 4 is now out. But the Early Years Report was a report card, I guess, or a public reporting system created by the Early Years Group, and looked at 5 categories of 19 internationally identified benchmarks, you know, gold standards for what quality early child education means, and put them on a 15-point scale. So 2010, that report came out, and, you know, Newfoundland was identified as having the poorest model of early child education in the country. So we used that report card as a call to public action and to drive out, you know, public awareness. We used it really as a roadmap forward, how we could improve our ranking and thereby improve the sector. When the second version came out in 2014, we were identified as being the most improved province in Canada, you know, through full-day kindergarten. Plans were announced by then. We had integrated governance by then. There was a greater investment. There was more spaces available. So there was a lot of improvements in a short order. The next report is due out in March of this year. It's the 2020 version that got delayed due to the pandemic, so it's coming out in March 2021. And I'm keenly interested in where we will rank in that. You know, how have we done since then? Is our improvement trajectory continuing, or have we stalled, or have we regressed? So I think, you know, we all should be watching for that report, the Early Years Education Report. It's easily Google, you know, you can easily find that on Google. My guess is that we have improved in governance and accountability, more public accountability around the what's happening with the early years. We may have improved in quality because there's more reliance on the operating grants program, which caps fees for parents, gives a better wage for educators, and monitors quality. So I think we've improved on that, but I think we probably need to focus on access. I mean, we have space for about 40% of the province's kids in an early child education environment, and only a third of our kids go to an environment. So I think access is an issue for this province, especially for children with special needs. We know that children with exceptionalities have, you know, autism kids, for example, do not have access to quality early learning environments. I think we probably also need to be focusing on improved or enhanced opportunities for professional development of the early child educators and greater links with the K-12 system. So my prediction is that we have improved, but there's also areas, you know, that we can continue to move forward with.
We've been talking about some of the educational and developmental benefits of early childhood education, but what are the economic benefits?
Well, it's wise fiscal policy in that, you know, the return on investment is significant. It more than pays for itself. A guy named Craig Alexander, who's a chief economist with Deloitte now, but he at the time he was with the Conference Board of Canada, I think, he did a study called Ready for Life, and you can easily Google that, Ready for Life. And what he identified was the economic benefits of early child education across the lifespan, that children who have, you know, at least 2 years of quality early learning, they have higher high school graduation rates, they have higher educational outcomes, they have higher participation in post-secondary universities, they have higher paying jobs, they pay more taxes, they're more likely to go on to a graduate degree, they have less reliance on social programs, they end up in the justice system significantly less, there's less addictions, there's less mental health issues, there's more citizen engagement. These are the children who have the social skills and the confidence to become involved in civic politics and civic opportunities. They're very engaged members of society. So the short-term benefit, you know, pays for itself through boosted employment and higher taxes, but the long-term benefit is exponential from an economic perspective. So international economists around the world recognize that the best way to boost an economy is to invest in the early years because of the immediate and long-term sustained change. It's the investment that keeps on giving returns.
Is there a demographic impact? I'm thinking in terms of last time I was in Quebec, for instance, and I know they have some progressive kind of programs to try and help with building up their own population. And everywhere I turned, it seemed to me that young families had that third child, one, two, three. Nowadays, we see people, I mean, three children nowadays is considered a big family. One time, it was a small family. So does it have demographic impacts as well? Will it attract more immigration? Will it help people in deciding, should I stay or should I go?
Well, we know that access to childcare is one of the deciding factors in young families' decisions to move for jobs. Yes, they'll look at, you know, the salary and the benefits of the job. They'll look at the cost of living second, and they'll also look very closely at the access to early child education placements for their children. And that's a critical factor for many young families. And quite often, the deciding factor, I mean, moms in particular, they have to look at whether or not they can afford to place a child in daycare, or will it be cheaper for them to stay home? So it's a critical factor in young families, both in moving as well as in the decision to have a second child. I mean, most families, you ask why they stopped at one or why they only had two, and their answer is, you know, we can't afford a third. It's just too expensive. So that's often, you know, a deciding factor. But boosting the population is a little bit more complicated than that, especially in a context of international migration and families, you know, drawing international families. We know international families tend to have larger families anyway. So it's a much more complicated thing. We know that, for example, the $1,000 boost bonus if you have another child in Newfoundland, the Conservative government brought in a number of years ago, we know that had no impact whatsoever. I mean, in 2010, we had 70,000 school-aged children. In 2020, this year, we have 63,000. So we've lost 7,000 kids in our population. If that keeps going down, we're at a crisis. I mean, I often say that the biggest challenge facing Newfoundland is not the price of a barrel of oil, it's the declining population of our children.
My guest today on Target is Dr. David Philpott. We're talking about early childhood education. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
We're talking to Dr. David Philpott, a retired professor with Munn's Faculty of Education, specializing in special education, but also very involved in early childhood education. He's also a research associate with the Atkinson Center for Society and Child Development. We're talking early childhood education, of course. And Dr. Philpott, is expanded access to early childhood education good gender policy?
Oh, very much so. We know that access to child care negatively impacts mothers' income, mothers' career trajectory. It is a part of the glass ceiling. It is a part of the reason why women can't retire as young as men. For example, I retired, you know, relatively young in my mid-50s, slash late-50s by now, whereas people who, because I had uninterrupted career time, I had uninterrupted service, whereas most of my female counterparts, they had to take time off to raise their children, and so they're having to continue to work for another 4 or 5 plus years. And you know, single moms in particular, the link with families in poverty and access to early child education is very, very well researched. So it's heavily gendered. But you know, it's changing too. For example, in Quebec, the investment in early child education in Quebec saw more fathers take paternity leave for the first time. You know, and I wonder how different our world would be if every father were able to take 6 months or a year off and stay home and care for their young children. How much would that impact society and the, you know, experience of fathers in the country, and with expanded paternity leave? And that's why the federal government is a huge piece of this conversation, with expanded paternity leave, where parents can share extended child care leave and share it between the two of them, affords fathers a greater opportunity. We know that this is, remains remarkably gendered, and that moms are the ones who deal with child development for the most part. And in 40 years, that has not shifted a lot. But in the last number of years of my career, I started to notice that dads were stepping up more and more.
And, you know, you'd have to fight me not to take care of my boy. I don't know. I just that was something I wanted to do. I wanted to take that time. That meant a lot to me. And again, you know, it took me out of the workforce for a short period of time anyway. But, it you know, very true. Not that my husband didn't want to be involved, but it was me that wanted it.
If you know, wouldn't it be great if all families fought over who gets to stay home with the children?
Yeah.
Which parent can best afford to take some time off?
Well,
and
yeah,
home, right?
And not a lot of people have those choices.
Home,
yeah,
right. You know, you stay home for a year, and the dad stay home for 6 months or a year. You know, like alternate. I mean, if options. I mean, if a parent chooses to return to work early, that's their choice, and I fully support that. If a parent chooses to stay home, I fully support that. It's not about what's the right decision. It's what's the best decision for this family, and the family having options. Right now, they have no options, and they're desperate trying to figure out how to make it work.
Don't get me started on the unemployment system and the slash in my salary that I had to take as a result of that. But anyway, that's a whole other issue. Negotiations are underway between the federal and provincial governments on funding of child care. What should we be looking for here?
Well, this is a critical opportunity. This is a one-time opportunity that comes along very, very seldomly. And it's underscored by the impact of the pandemic. I mean, in 2017, after years of the child care sector being willfully ignored by the Conservative government, who felt this is a family's responsibility, deal with it yourself, the Trudeau government, the Liberal government, recognized the importance of the federal government in stepping in to support a national child care initiative. And they established bilateral agreements with each of the provinces to, you know, to improve access and have greater inclusion. 4 years later, we see now that, you know, the provinces that had the best impact were the provinces who used that federal money strategically to build infrastructure, you know, and long-lasting, you know, capital within their provinces for the early years. So right now, those contracts are up for renewal. And this is a real opportunity for our premier, a father of young kids who intuitively gets the importance of the early years. You know, both parents work, have successful careers. He's a strong supporter of $25 a day child care. So it's a real opportunity for our premier to step up and display leadership and to inform those negotiations and make sure that three critical pieces in those negotiations have to be long-term capacity, not short-term expending money or giving bursaries or paying for a couple of spaces, but think long-term capacity. And secondly, improving quality, not just increasing quantity of space, but improving quality, you know, through professional learning, through strong curriculum frameworks, et cetera. And three, to align it with the K-12 school system. I mean, we cannot have two education systems in our country. We have to have one continuum of education that begins in the early years and transitions into the K-12 system. The neighborhood school is a community's greatest resource in meeting the needs of young families. And we need to tie the early sector closer to that system to ensure a continuum of learning for their children, a one-stop shop for families, and long-term infrastructure that will really last, you know, long after these federal dollars dry up.
Should it be more of a federal involvement in early childhood education? We think in terms of health care across the country. I know the provinces are still responsible, but, you know, there's certain truths that we all know right across Canada. Should the federal government be playing a greater role in all of that?
Well, we know when they do, they benefit. We know when they do, the provinces benefit. And in the absence of that, you know, we have a very fragile female labor force. We have a high social programs. We have a high federal justice program. We pay the price of not having quality early learning in those environments. And if it's done right and supported over 5 years, within 5 years and with increased federal funding and strategic use of that funds by the provinces, we could reach the goal of having 70% of Canada's young children having access to quality early learning environment, which is the average enrollment in countries that are Canada's economic competitors. Right now, we have 50% of our kids have access to that. So if our international competitors have access for 70% of the kids, there is no reason in the world why Canada can't reach that goal.
Where do we stand, you know, globally when it comes to these kinds of issues? Who are the most progressive countries, and how far do we need to go to get to that top spot?
Well, among the OECD countries, we are, you know, about the developed countries, we are one of the poorest in quality of early learning and space for our children. The leaders by far are the Scandinavian countries, which have universal access, which have really strong play-based programs, which, you know, every child is in a quality early learning environment until they're six. There's a huge focus on play. There's a huge focus on communication with the families, huge focus on professional development for their educators. These children start school with a very big advantage, and that advantage sustains itself. I mean, if we want a healthy forest, we focus on healthy nurseries. If we want to look at the food chain, we talk about the plants and the seeds. And the same thing with child development. If we want healthy education outcomes, we got to start early. Waiting until they're 7 or 10 years of age to intervene is too late.
You were talking about Scandinavia. They also have a strong emphasis on outdoors.
Yes.
And I know that we're getting more progressive when it comes to that sort of thing. Schools and childcare centers now making sure that there's outdoor time. How important is that?
Oh, critical. Absolutely critical. And again, Scandinavian countries lead the way on that. I mean, when their reading scores went down in one of the Scandinavian countries, they increased play. And lo and behold, reading scores went back up. We're seeing more schools here in Newfoundland starting to recognize that. I mean, when I was on the task force, I heard countless examples of schools putting movies on during lunch hour to keep the kids quiet. But now what we're hearing is that, you know, schools are really profiling how much time they're outdoors. I've just become involved in the Cloudberry Forest School, which is an outdoor early learning environment here in St. John's, and I'm going to be doing some evaluation work with them. And that's a fascinating program, you know, with really impressive outcomes. So, you know, outdoor play, and we live in the coldest province, or one of the coldest provinces, with extreme weather here. If you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes, it's going to change. But even here, outdoor play is extremely important to child development.
My son said to me the other day, he was so disappointed because the class wasn't listening to the teacher and weren't getting their whatever it was that the assignments they had to do done at a certain time, and that meant that they cut back on their outdoor, and he was so upset that they didn't get to go outside for their full allotted time. So it does have an impact.
Absolutely. When they come to their learning tasks after having, you know, sufficient playtime, they are ready to learn. The brain is engaged, the body is engaged, the mind is focused.
Dr. David Philpott, we could talk for hours about this. It's a fascinating topic for certain. I really appreciate your time this afternoon. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you for the opportunity.
He's been our guest today on Target. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about Mount Cashel with lawyer Jeff Budden. Stay tuned for that. We'll be back tomorrow, and thanks for listening.